The House Committee on Revenue will come to order. Colleagues, welcome back. It's great to be back in the Capitol today. And our first order of business is the adoption of the committee rules, which are to be found in OLIS, listed under committee materials, meeting materials. Paul, do you want to tell us about changes in the committee rules, and then we'll take a motion.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, welcome, committee members. The standard rules are before you, and I think you'll be familiar with just about all of them. The only one that's had some discussion and some modification in the interim is number 10, which is for the introduction of not so much by the for committee bills, but for amendments. The amendment requestor will appear on the copy of the amendment. So if we make a request for a committee one, whenever we go to council, it would be the committee on House Revenue, and it'll show up on that amendment, and you'll see that when you get the amendment. If you go down as an individual and request an amendment, your name will show up on that printed copy. So that's the change, and I think in the past the practice has been just to leave that blank and then have it explained. So it should be on those amendments when you get them.
Essentially, it's conforming to the rules that we adopted earlier today.
Yes, and it refers to House Rule 8.23, which is the rule you adopted today on the floor.
All right. Anything else? Any other changes? Oh, Representative Davis.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Having worked with the chair on revisions with the chief clerk to these rules, you might notice if you spend all your spare time comparing them to past rules that the order has been changed substantially for things, and we've deleted a number of rules and sub-rules that really didn't make any sense with past practice, but the intent was not any changes in substance. But a word for the wise or the wary when it comes to the introduction of committee measures: if you hope to have somebody besides yourself named on the committee measure as the requester, you have to send that request concurrently with the amendment request itself. So in the same email or on the same document, you have to say, I'm requesting that this be this amendment say at the request of the Oregon Society to Better Society. I've been told Legislative Council may add some grace, but my attempts to have some grace added were denied. And so if you send it a half an hour later, they may say, sorry, it's already in the system and it's going to have your name attached to the amendment.
Great. Thank you. This rule is written in an interesting way, 8.23, and I think Representative Davis has captured the essence of it very well. The first part of the rule suggests that there's only two ways you can get an amendment listed. One is at the request of a committee, and the other was at the request of a member. But then the second part of the rule basically says there's another thing you can do, and he's referring to the other thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Other discussion? Representative Vance?
Chair, I move adoption of the committee rules.
Representative Vance moves the adoption of the committee rules. Is there further discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the rules are adopted. Informational meeting, committee overview. Paul, that's your topic, I think.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I just had one thing I just wanted to mention to the members that you should find in your meeting materials the basic facts.
Yes.
20's always good late night reading.
Hot off the press.
So we updated it, and that's been one of the adjustments we've made to annual sessions is to update this document annually. So it's familiar material, and but we've just updated you'll find your the same substance it's had in there before with just updated numbers. We've added a few things like transit lodging tax, 911 tax that we hadn't before, so we're trying to make it these issues you've dealt with in recent years. So that's for your reading pleasure.
Thank you. May I put in a little commercial for this? There are those who are probably here in the room. There are others who I'm sure are watching with great care on the internet, many, many, many thousands of them. And I would commend this document, the basic facts document, which is, again, contained in today's meeting materials list, second item, for your perusal. Many, many, many questions about Oregon's taxation, system of taxation, how it works, and who pays, and all of those things can be found in this document. It is, as our legislative revenue officer has indicated very clearly, not light reading, but it is extremely informative. When you are thinking about asking a question, if it's already been answered in basic text, you might not need to ask it. Anything else with that item, Paul?
The only other thing I would mention, Mr. Chair, is that Edward Klein, our committee assistant, is back with us again for the interim, and we welcome and are lucky to have him back available to us.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much. And with that, we'll nobody's asked any changes in the order of things, so we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 4084. And it sounds like we're going to get an explanation. Mazin.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We'll come back to the 2016 session. It's my distinct pleasure to bring you the first bill of your esteemed committee. This might look a little familiar from previous sessions or session. This comes from the Brownsfields issue in the session previously, which is just passed, the 2015. You dealt with this issue with House Bill 2734. Remember this bill that went through three committees, and some of the members seen it a couple, three times in different committees. And at that time, the House Bill 2734 created the Land Bank Authority and gave it the different powers and construction of how to deal with the issues of bonding and the governance of that authority and so on. And at that time, because of the exemption of the property tax and the construction of that exemption and abatement of property tax was not clear and ready, it was postponed out of that bill, and it was a discussion process after session, and I believe now that this bill in front of you brings that issue into light. So that's what the bill is trying to do, and I understand there might be other amendments coming before the bill is ready, but the discussion seems to have brought this bill in front of you after the previous one in 2015.
Welcome. Thank you very much for coming to tell us all about House Bill 4084.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart and committee members. My name is Caddy McKeown. I represent House District 9 down on the South Coast, and I'm very happy to be bringing this bill to you today. And I thank you for hearing it. The concept of this bill came out of House Bill 2289, originally introduced in the 2015 session. During the time this bill was in the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development, it sparked some very good conversation around brownfield development. And as a result of the ideas put forward in 2015, when it came time to formulate priorities for the 2016 session, I wanted to identify the key element of 2289, the tax abatement for brownfield development, extract it as a standalone measure, and approach the 2016 session with the intent to create this incentive option for our local municipalities. Working closely with the Brownfields Coalition, my community leaders back home, as well as with my vice chairs, Representative Frederick, we have drafted a bill that's specific, the vice chairs of my Transportation and Economic Development Committee. Representative Davis and Representative Gorsuch. I drafted a bill that's specific, direct, and results in a voluntary option that may be enacted should a community determine that it would aid their local economic development processes. Our Vice Chair Gorsuch, Vice Chair Davis, and I are joined by Representative Frederick and Chief co-sponsoring this bill, which I'm very pleased to note. In addition to a number of bipartisan bicameral signatures, this bill has already garnered. I hope that you can join us in support of House Bill 4084, as we feel strongly that this will have a positive impact on the economic development of communities throughout Oregon, urban, rural, and across the state. And I sincerely thank you for hearing the bill. I'm happy to answer questions. I have my colleagues here to speak to the bill as well, and then I believe Mr. Tucker is here, who's been very involved in the details of drafting this bill and can answer questions as well. Thank you.
Great. Gentlemen.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. I'm State Representative John Davis, House District 26, the fighting 26th. Thank you for the opportunity to share with you about our Brownfields property tax abatement bill for the 2016 session. It's really been a pleasure in the interim to work closely with certain members of the Brownfields Coalition, personally having a number of meetings with the group to try to move the ball forward for an opportunity, A, to redevelop those brownfields in each of our communities with a bill that could work both for rural communities and for urban communities to provide a completely voluntary option and another tool in the proverbial toolkit of local governments to redevelop brownfields property on the one hand, and two, spur job creation, industrial development, and real living wage jobs in our communities. I'll give sort of a high level on some of the technicalities of the bill and then would be happy to answer specific questions and some differences from this bill compared to that which was in last session. You'll recall we passed a land bank authority last session. This is not a land bank authority. You recall we discussed a tax credit last session. This is not a tax credit. You recall we discussed a property tax exemption or special assessment for the land only of brownfields. This bill is that, and also adds the potential for the improvements on the property and the equipment and personal property that's taxed as part of our property tax system to enjoy this exemption. There are a number of limiting factors. First is that the exemption will be limited to the actual cost of cleanup. So we always talk about the potential for runaway tax breaks and are we going to give away the farm. Here we have a self-limiting factor in this bill where the exemption could be no greater than the actual certified costs of cleanup on a site. The exemption would be for up to 10 years, and local governments would have the option to add additional criteria as they so choose, trying to provide an opportunity for a tool for local governments to add additional 5 years with additional specified bonuses, one might say. And those could be developed by the local government. So if they wanted to add bonuses for job creation, bonuses for the particular type of use of property, they could enjoy up to 15 years, but really starts at the 10-year. There is a sunset built into this bill. We've become accustomed to doing that as a way to impose review upon these policies, and that's included, although it escapes me what the sunset is right now. I believe it's maybe 20 years, and for a 10-year, 15 years, and for a 10-year program, that seemed appropriate to us. It would require the consent of 51% of the taxing districts in the jurisdiction. We have had a request to increase that to 75, and that's all parties that we've talked about have been amenable to that. So the special districts, library districts, cities, counties, anybody in the jurisdiction, we'd have to hit the 75% mark in order for this ordinance to pass. And it's also available for the tailoring of local communities. We've tried to provide a framework in this bill so that a community, a rural community who doesn't have a large staff to develop programs, could take this template and implement it if they so chose. But also providing the flexibility if there are jurisdictions that wanted to get fancy, so to speak, and add their own criteria and develop a more sophisticated program, that they would also have the flexibility to do that. So really, we've tried to make a bill that works for all of Oregon, not just a specified city or a specified region, that provides a tool that doesn't go too far, that starts out incrementally, and could work for all of Oregon. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you about it, and I'm happy to answer any questions or direct the really difficult ones to Randy Tucker later on. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. I'm Representative Lou Frederick, House District 43. That's North and Northeast Portland. I'm going to share with you some of the reasons I've brought some kind of brownfields bill to the Assembly every session I've been here. This is a subject that flies under the radar for many, but when one of these sites happens to be around the corner from you or an empty lot that your kids want to play in, it gets pretty real. When I first began researching this subject, I found that there were over 140 of these small contaminated sites in my district. As we looked a little deeper, we found that the absolute numbers in all districts are pretty much similar. They may be farther apart in districts that are more spread out, but it's a problem in every district in the state. These are small contaminated areas, unusable due to their condition, but not qualifying for major programs such as Superfund. They are old gas stations and mechanic shops where there's a lasting legacy of the way petroleum products and solvents were handled in earlier decades. They are old dry cleaners and photo finishing shops and battery stores. They are places where farm chemicals were stored and mixed and taken out into the field, sometimes chemicals that are no longer allowed on crops. In many, possibly most cases, the individuals or entities that caused the contamination are long gone. The property may have changed hands multiple times. In some cases, those acquiring these properties are unaware of the barriers to development or even minimal use. Sometimes the heirs of the original owners do not know what to do with their inherited property. There was a property in my neighborhood that was vacant, dilapidated, for decades. It wasn't just an eyesore. The soil was soaked with chemical solvents. I'm happy to say in the past year somebody has made significant investment to clean it up sufficiently to build on it. And I'm also happy to say that part of the reason they were able to develop this property is because we passed a bill in 2013 that identified what was needed to clean up that property. While there's costs associated with developing brownfields, there are significant economic and social costs that can be avoided by using this available land. In my neighborhood, for example, developers are tearing down perfectly good homes to build bigger ones, often facing vigorous neighborhood opposition. But neighbors rarely oppose redevelopment of a brownfield. Our cities need this land for economic, social, and aesthetic reasons. And finally, these properties are generally in locations that, but for the contamination, would be ready for development, with zoning issues and utility access already solved. So that's why I've supported a variety of approaches to reducing the barriers to redevelopment of brownfields. I don't think that any one approach will solve every case, but I hope that we can continue to develop a greater variety of tools so that we can reduce this toxic burden on our neighborhoods, whether they're urban, suburban, or rural. Thank you for letting me bring forward things, and I'll pass along any questions to John and to Tucker as well. So there we go.
All right. Questions for this panel? I think you got off light.
Yeah, we did.
Wow.
Thank you.
Of course, I still have to be up there.
That's right. Your next chance, right.
Thank you
very much for your testimony. And now we'll call Randy Tucker and his panel. Oh, excuse me. I just realized what I need to do temporarily is to recess the hearing on House Bill 4084. We will get to that panel. We'll recess that hearing. We'll temporarily open the public hearing on House Bill 4081 and ask Representative Evans to give his testimony. Then we're going to excuse him so we can get on to other work and come back to 4084.
Chair, do you want me to testify with him right now or wait?
Go ahead.
I'm on this bill.
You're on that one, too?
Yeah.
Well, you shouldn't have come up then, should you?
Well, I didn't know we were going.
You didn't know we were going. All right.
I'll refer the tough questions to him.
While we're waiting for him, why don't you get started?
Thank you. Thank you. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, thank you very much for adjusting the schedule and having me here to present this bill. And thank you, Representative Davis, Vice Chair, for joining me down here. I am Paul Evans. I represent the people of House District 20, which is Monmouth, Independence, West Salem, parts of South Salem. I really do appreciate the opportunity to present House Bill 4081 for your consideration. It is one of the priority bills, and it is actually, in my opinion, the exact kind of bill that the February session was designed to do, to handle tweaking problems related to long-term problems. The bill provides certainty to nonprofit providers of low-income housing that have relied upon property tax exemptions granted under ORS 307.130 prior to 2012 in order to make the finances of housing programs viable. The bill removed the 2018 sunset from House Bill 4039, passed in 2014, and maintain the property tax exemption for these properties as long as the criteria outlined in House Bill 4039 are met. I think that's the most numbers I can fit into a particular paragraph. Bottom line is this. The bill will actually maintain the status quo. And I'm a simple guy. At a time where we're looking at expanding access to available housing, this bill will help protect housing that already exists and folks that are already living in housing in this region. And I don't ask this lightly. As a former mayor and city councilor, I am very aware of the impacts of property tax relief on city services. In fact, 50% plus of the city of Monmouth is non-taxable. So I really do understand this issue. That said, this is an important enough thing for us to get through and to maintain certainty for that I believe this bill is warranted. Again, it will maintain the status quo, and it will ensure that the folks that are already currently providing housing opportunities for those purposes in those places have the tools to continue to do so. That's all the bill is about. I will next hand over the heavy lifting to my friend and colleague next door.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee, and thank you, Representative Evans, for bringing this bill. I'll give Representative Evans credit and the proponents. When this bill was brought to me, it was not one that was on my radar until legislative days, and I saw it and said this
and,
is...
And for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. For the record, State Representative John Davis, House District 26, the fight in 26. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. This is a very important bill because I've personally seen the effects of the uncertainty that the lack of this bill can provide. So if you recall, I actually pulled up our session laws from 2014 when we passed the original bill with the sunset in it, and I'll just remind you what the bill actually does. For low-income, for nonprofit low-income housing providers, so this we're talking about nonprofits that provide low-income housing, who on or beginning July 1st, 2012, actually offered low-income housing to the residents, would continue to be grandfathered in on the exclusion from property tax granted under the nonprofit provisions of our property tax exemptions. We know that there's lots of work going on in that area. There's a special committee or a task force looking at the nonprofit exemptions right now. That's very important work. Why this bill is important to provide certainty for this specific subset of nonprofits, I've seen in my particular practice. I represent a number of nonprofits in my legal practice who enjoy this exemption and who offer low-income housing. And I've seen the pro formas that they give to me about the risk of an assessor assessing full property tax on properties that might have 50, 100, 200, 300 units of housing. That's a very valuable piece of property. And the monthly impact to the budget of these nonprofits would be substantial. And I've seen the pro formas of what rents would increase and have to increase in order for these entities to continue operating. They're not operating for profit. They're operating not for profit. They're not taking something off the top. They are at the margins trying to offer housing as low cost as possible to their residents. And removing the certainty that this bill would provide and that our current law provides would, again, just put them in a position of having to make ends meet, and the only way to do that is to increase revenue through the raising of rents. So I wanted to share that personal story. It's why I jumped on this bill as a co-chief sponsor. I want to thank the proponents. Be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative.
I just have one for Rep. Evans. You made a statement about when you were mayor of Monmouth that 50% of the properties. Could you say that again?
Sure, Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt. When the city of Monmouth has Western Oregon Now University in it, mm-hmm. as well as a number of adult care facilities that are not for profit. So when you actually look, when we looked at the annual budget of what properties were in the pot as far as paying property tax for services versus not, more than half of the city is actually not paying property taxes. It's a significant problem in a small town. That said, it's because I know that this works on a problem that we are all concerned about right now, where nonprofits that are in this business are doing the best they can. Even as a mayor of a town that would be strapped that way, I would still be supporting this bill, because if we're going to try to get any handle on the homelessness issue and the housing issues that we're struggling to find, we can't lose the stuff we already have. And since this right now has been in place, it's not going to be seen as anything that folks are expecting to be on the tax roll anyway, because it's been exempted or it's been under the sunset. So that's what I was trying to point out.
If I could follow up.
Please, go ahead.
I was just wondering, just for my information, about how much that equals, like in Monmouth, where half of the property, what does that equal monetarily to the city that they aren't collecting in taxes?
Well, I would have to defer to the folks running the city now, but at the time, it was in the neighborhood. We had an annual budget of around $16 million in general fund, and again, because the assessed valuation of the college buildings were, again, public, but yet if you tried to look at it, it was somewhere in the neighborhood of, I would say, at least $15 million that we weren't bringing in.
Thank
now,
you.
We did have, just for truth in advertising, water, electricity, those types of fees, but the actual property tax portion, they were off the map.
Anything else for this panel? Thank you so much. On to your other meeting.
Thank you very much.
All right, and with that, we will recess the public hearing on House Bill 4081 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 4084. Now, Mr. Tucker and panel.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. We've lost one of our panelists, but I hope she'll be back soon. That would be Wendy Johnson from the League of Cities. My name is Randy Tucker. I am the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro, and I'm afraid that my ability to explain this bill, I hope it hasn't been oversold, but I'll do my best. Let me just note for the record that we have submitted a letter, that one right there, today, that has the names of 25 or 30 different entities that are supporting the bill before you today, and I just learned from Representative McEwen's staff that we need to add to this list at the bottom, there we go, the City of Coos Bay and the International Port of Coos Bay. So I want to make sure that you're aware that there's very broad support for this this legislation. There are a few people in the room who represent entities that are supporting it, and they could raise their hands if they would. But of course, I think you know, thank you. I think you know that there are also multiple simultaneous hearings going on and people are scrambling. As Representative McEwen noted, we brought forth a piece of legislation last session that had elements of what's before you today. It came before this committee, and I'm still recovering from that experience. That's what they say about House revenue is, if you can make it there, you'll make it anywhere. I believe that's Representative Barnhart's line anyway. But I will say that he's always extolling the talent on this committee and how you put us through our paces, and I appreciate it. We made our legislation last session a lot better, and I hope we'll do the same this session. As noted, the bill was in this language or similar language was in the land bank bill that you passed last session, and then we took it out toward the end because it wasn't working for a variety of reasons, both technical, financial, and political. And that's a toxic combo right there. And I want to also reiterate what I believe Representative Frederick just said a minute ago, that this bill doesn't solve the brownfields problem. No single tool will solve the problem that's out there. There are thousands of brownfields around the state. There are different situations that affect different ones, and this tool hopefully will help to move some of them from basically being unused properties that are degrading the value of properties around them and the environment into community assets that are creating jobs and supporting tax revenues for local governments. So Representative Davis went through most of the provisions of the bill already. I'll just reiterate a couple of the things that he said, and then I'll add a couple more points, and then mention that there are going to be some amendments forthcoming, and I'll at a very high level mention those. Just to reiterate, this would create the authority but not require any local government to do anything. It would create the authority to pass an ordinance or resolution that would establish a program for providing property tax incentives to the owners of brownfields in order to support the cleanup and redevelopment of those properties. As noted by Representative Davis, we've added this session the ability to have an exemption on improvements and personal property, because we finally figured out late in the session that there wasn't enough of an incentive to actually turn these properties in the bill that we brought before you last time. And as noted also, I'll just reiterate, the total tax benefit that an owner can receive cannot exceed the cost of cleanup. So there's not going to be a runaway program, as noted before. A couple of things that Representative Davis didn't mention, I'll just add. One is that there are eligibility requirements that exclude parties who are liable for the contamination on their property for the reason that they were the polluter, or they exacerbated it, or they've concealed it. And I fielded many emails from lawyers over the weekend. We will be amending the language there to make sure we've got that right. But that's the intent, is to avoid allowing this incentive to be used by the entities that actually caused the problem in the first place. And there are other exclusions, federal Superfund sites and certain other exclusions in the bill. But in general, it's intended to be available to anyone who is not guilty of polluting the property in general. The bill lays out the application requirements. It lays out eligible costs, and it also has a process for clawback in the instance when an applicant doesn't carry through on his or her obligations, or where there's falsification of information, or you know, a variety of transgressions. One of the amendments would be to potentially add some language allowing the landowner to cure those transgressions if they're of a minor or paperwork nature. Also, you know, as mentioned, this would not go into effect at the local level unless districts representing 75% of the overall tax base in the jurisdiction that adopted the ordinance agree to it. So no one gets really rolled at the local level. Let me just mention, that's one of the amendments that will be coming in, because that's not in the bill right now, the 75% threshold. I'll just mention a few of the other things. Besides that, they're all of a technical nature, but I'll just mention a few of them. The term environmental site assessment appears several times in this bill, and as DEQ has pointed out, there's no such thing in Oregon law. And so we're going to be replacing that with words that actually are in Oregon law. And those will be site evaluation, preliminary assessment, confirmation of release, and remedial investigation. So we'll be replacing that term. There are various other definitions. The definition of what constitutes DEQ oversight, as I mentioned, the definition of who is ineligible, we're going to clean that up. I mentioned the opportunity to cure for an applicant or a participant of this program that has a relatively easy to fix violation that would otherwise be disqualifying. The county assessors have asked, there's a fair amount of work potentially for the county assessors, and they've requested the opportunity or the authority to charge a fee for the work they do. We'll be looking at some language that they propose and sharing that with the committee. I think that's all that needs to be mentioned right now. As I say, they're all of a relatively minor functional or technical nature and not of a policy nature, with the exception of the threshold for agreement among the local taxing districts. So I'll stop there, let my colleagues testify, or be happy to answer any questions at your convenience.
Thank you. I think we'll take questions after you've all had a chance.
Great.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Fries with Associated Oregon Industries. We're the state's largest business association, representing about 1,500 members. Our interest really in this bill, and our members' interest in this bill, is kind of twofold. One is we have a small group of members that are developers, so this could be something that they could take advantage of in the future. But I think even more broadly, we have a lot of members that live in communities with brownfields that have have been derelict for some time, and so they're either a neighbor, they own a neighboring property, or they're in the community, and they would like to see those cleaned up. You know, improves the tax base as a whole, and just as a part of a business development, economic development driver in the community. So about a year ago, I had a few members that approached me and said, "Hey, we, you know, you're new. We'd like to kind of explore some new opportunities in brownfields development, which is really important to us, and we'd like you to kind of see what you can come up with." Well, there was a coalition effort long underway, and so I started in there, but then also took the opportunity in meeting with a number of other states to review policies that work, for instance, in New York and Pennsylvania and other places on the East Coast that have been doing this a little bit longer and have kind of went through different iterations of policies. As it turns out, there's not kind of that one-size-fits-all policy option. And so after a number of conversations, this one seemed, without having to provide significant revenue towards developing or cleaning up these sites, this really seemed to be one really good option for Oregon to, at a minimum, see if this is something that will really is enough incentive to drive cleanup of these sites and development of these sites into the future. So after, you know, working again with the coalition and members of the committee, we really do think this is an important tool to put in place. What the success rate will depend upon how many municipalities or local governments choose to participate in the program, and we hope that they do. And from the list of supporters on the letter, we think that that will happen. And if we do find some roadblocks or some issues in continuing to promote or incentivize the development of these sites, then we can come back to you and hopefully remove those roadblocks. But in order to really find out whether or not this will, in fact, be enough to incent these development and cleanup of these sites, we need to put something in place, and we think this is the right step. So happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Wendy Johnson, here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. The League has been a coalition member since the beginning, I guess, of the Brownfield Coalition, and the property tax area is in my portfolio, so I've been working on this with the coalition for quite some time, and we strongly support this bill. First, it's a tool. As I talked to many of you, there are lots of different tools for cleaning up brownfields, but not one will fix all of them. You need various tools to address the different types of fact patterns and circumstances. The feds used to have an income tax credit that was great. We don't have that one anymore, and there's no state income tax credit either. So property tax exemptions and incentives are one way to go that other states have used and other cities and counties have used. And this one will work for some. We know it won't work for all. There's some exclusions for good reason, so we know those won't reach to those, but this is a new tool for the toolkit, and we think it will be beneficial for two reasons. I think it's been mentioned many times, it's both an economic development tool and also an environmental help. We have lots of properties that are, you know, not healthy for our environment, and it will clean up that, but it'll also be an economic development tool. Economic development for the property that's contaminated. They will bring in more property tax revenues once it's cleaned up, and more income tax for the jobs that are whatever business goes on there. And economic development for the neighboring properties will improve their values. And also just the jobs of whoever's doing that cleanup, there's economic development. So there's just a multifaceted economic development plus with this bill, as well as the environmental. You've heard me speak on many property tax exemption bills before this committee, and the but-for issue always comes up, and we feel like this one does meet the but-for. The development would not get cleaned up but for this incentive. We have over 13,000 brownfields in Oregon. Many of them have been sitting there for many, many years, and they're not getting cleaned up. And this will help get some of those cleaned up. They wouldn't be done but for this incentive. The second part of but-for, it's a local option. So if the facts are different in a particular city, county, or port, they can change the criteria and make, you know, and change the incentive. So it's not a giveaway, and it does meet the but-for test. So we feel like it can be narrowly tailored to make sure that we are not giving away dollars that should be spent for government services or school services. So it is nearly tailored. We're happy that it has a sunset. We think property tax exemptions, just like income tax credits, should be reviewed periodically, so we know that they're doing what they should be doing, so we're happy with that provision. And lastly, we think it hits that sweet spot of making it a program that can work in rural and urban, and not giving away the farm. It's got a cap of the up to the cost of cleanup. That's what you can get back on your incentive. We tried all kinds of other ways of percentages or dollars, and it's just too complicated to figure out. But we feel like this is that sweet spot. But it may need tinkering in the future. We don't know to see how many properties actually take advantage of it. But we feel like this is the right place of providing enough detail that some of our cities and counties can just take it as is, and others can make it more complex with more criteria and such. So it fits all of our needs. And we think this really is an economic development tool for the whole state. So we encourage your support.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? Yes, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you guys for all the hard work on this. There's a question I had, Mr. Chair, on page 4, line 26. And it just said the eligible costs are offset by that which is received by the owner. Do you mean the owner at the time, or are you looking back? Is this a forward-looking word? Is it, because I know of situations where people have received monies for this type of cleanup, and then they unloaded the property on somebody else, absconded with the money. This is looking forward. Is that what that's intended?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, the owner is the applicant in this situation, so it would be that owner that we're talking about.
Thank you.
So forward.
Please, yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is the way I was going to frame this question is to ask who it is that's paying, and I want to share my vision of this and see if I have it right. The idea is, isn't it, that we would waive the real property taxes on someone who is approved by the various taxing districts, and then they would enjoy no tax for a period of 10 and perhaps 15 years on that, on the building and the hard assets inside the building, and that money that they don't pay, then they would use to clean it up. The money that they don't pay would otherwise have gone for our schools and other things, and thus the rest of us pick up the tab for that which they're not paying. The example I kept in my mind was a low-income housing project with 200 people, all of whom had 3 kids, and they all went to local schools. And but there wouldn't be any property tax paid by that housing unit. Maybe it's exempt anyway. So the other half of the building, I theorized, was a server farm or something with huge amounts of, well, wait, I guess we let them off the hook, didn't we, Mr. Chair? So it would have to be somebody else that
excluded them from this benefit.
I'm sorry, right. So it would have to be something. But the point is, whatever the law enforcement, the streets, all the stuff that normally these taxes pay for, everybody else is paying for. Why we wait for this 15 years to go by, and then they get to utilize what they would have otherwise paid, hopefully, to clean this up. So is it correct for me to say that the state and the local communities are the ones picking up the cost of the cleanup?
I'll start. Wendy probably wants to answer, too. This is I'm Randy again. Representative Barnhart, Representative Bentz. First of all, it's not correct to say that the state would be picking it up, because this is only a property tax exemption.
Can I interrupt?
Yeah, I think that would be a good time to interrupt.
Right.
Yeah, please.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
sounds
and
like I've walked
back
into
to my
something.
200 kids. Going to the public schools, doesn't the state pick up a big chunk of that? And isn't there a means of equalizing? What I'm trying to say is I think the state is picking up part of it, at least if I look at just the schools.
Mm-hmm. Let me rephrase my answer. The state is not sacrificing any tax revenues under this program, I believe is a more precise answer. Because the tax revenues that would be waived or exempted would only be local property tax revenues. So, yes, there could be costs associated with a project that is built on a brownfield that the state would be bearing. But those would be borne whether the tax was exempt or not. Let me step back to the basic question I think you're asking. Our assumption going forward with this is that most of the properties that we're trying to where we're trying to incent some cleanup are not producing tax revenues at any significant level right now because they're contaminated and because they can't be used. It's true, there may be properties that are large and have one brownfield over in the corner, and So we have the limitation that the benefit cannot exceed the cost of cleanup. I should also note that the local government can choose for the benefit to be less than the cost of cleanup and can also choose to provide less than a 10-year exemption. So there is flexibility for the local governments to create their program to scale it properly for their own local circumstances. But it's true that ultimately if there are improvements on that property, that those improvements wouldn't pay the property taxes until either the end of the time period or the amount of the cleanup has been covered, depending on the local program.
And I'm not saying I'm objecting to the bill. I just want to isolate who it is that's actually paying the bill. And it appears to me that what's really going on, because we wouldn't be collecting property taxes for all of the things the rest of us have to pay for.
Right.
That the rest of us are paying for it. The law enforcement protection, all the local government stuff that whoever is on that property now is enjoying. I like law enforcement the best because for some reason it's on the top of my mind right now, being from Eastern Oregon.
Right.
The point is,
got it.
I kind of like the thought of everybody paying for that, but these folks wouldn't be for 15 years, but they would enjoy that. So the rest of us pay for it. So I just want you two guys to tell me if I've got it right or not. If somebody else is paying, then yay, who is it?
You've got it right.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I think you're right that there's obviously you're giving up an exemption and a special assessment, so there's a benefit to that owner that's getting this benefit, getting this incentive program granted. But as you said, these are empty lots. Generally, we're getting nothing on, no taxes are being paid, but it's actually a detriment to the community. And so giving up something while we're getting nothing is our long-term goal, as we want to, you know, reverse that situation so we're getting something back. We'll still be getting income tax, the state will, which, as you know, goes mostly to the school fund. So once that property is developed and there's an incentive to get it developed quickly because you only get the exemption for the 10 years and potentially 15. So if you take forever to get it cleaned up, you're not going to get any benefit for the improvement you put on that lot. So if you get it cleaned up quickly, you put a new business on there, we're getting income tax dollars that we don't have now. And we're improving the neighborhood and improving all of those properties as well. So we think we're not getting any money now. So this is going to help long term. And it's, as you said, it's capped at cost. So we're not giving up a significant portion here. But in that window, we are giving up something, but we feel like the long term benefit outweighs that short term cost.
Yes, please. Yeah.
We would hope what you say is true. We wouldn't know until we saw what it was that was built and how much local government expenses were required for whatever the nature of that improvement might be. That's why I used the 200-child example, because today that bare lot isn't generating that kind of cost. It's just a big zero. We bring in that kind of improvement, tomorrow all kinds of cost, but no taxes to pay it, no property taxes.
Property tax.
So what I'm trying to say is the example that you are using may in the long run be right, may not, I don't know. But in the meantime, all the rest of us will pay more because we'll have to, because there will be a required, I will use law enforcement again, need for that now improved property. Again, I'm not saying I object. I just want everybody to be clear on who it is that's paying.
Understood.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, I think there's also kind of the inverse of that conversation where the current property, probably the surrounding neighbors are paying for the cost of that plight, that the public isn't necessarily picked that up yet. So if you improve the property, then you improve the value of the properties around that, which should increase local revenue. Now, probably not to the point, to the extent that you're suggesting, to make up for lost revenue, but otherwise it's just that property just sits there and doesn't provide that benefit, other than it does have a cost on probably on the neighboring properties. So
thank you,
Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative Davis, and then Representative Woodson.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you all for testifying. I'll just add a comment, which is I think we're at the nut of the question. And when I originally kind of jumped on board after the session liking this idea, I was a proponent of the idea of a full property tax exemption for either 5 or 10 years, which is what many states who have these programs offer. And that, I think, after reflection and hearing from the coalition, hearing the research that had been done, it seemed to me that after that, exemptions, particularly those in states that are up to 10 years, really do fall in the category that Representative Benz is discussing. Of on the out years, you're giving away substantial amounts of revenue as a local government, perhaps for nothing. I don't think the but-for test is met in those situations. And the limiting factor here of capping the exemption at the cleanup costs, when you look at those cleanup costs, which could be substantial for a larger property, but in light of the entire value of a potential industrial development or redevelopment, I think in many instances it won't be zero tax that's paid. It will be a portion of the property tax that would be payable that will be exempt. So having that limiting factor in there was key to me after reflection, after hearing from those who were proponents and also had done the research.
Thank you. Representative Whitson.
For example, I believe we have a brownfield in the middle of the suburban Klamath Falls area. It's 15 acres. It was a former garage for the county road.
Oh, no.
And so it has road shop buildings on it. It's 15 acres literally in downtown Klamath Falls. And so we would be looking at a substantial reduction of property tax on the most valuable property in the city for someone. I just want to confirm that that's what, am I understanding that? That for 10 years they wouldn't be, I recognize it's county property right now, so I don't really know how the tax structure set up, but you know, there are other things there. We have mill sites. We have really big brownfields in our county. And so do I understand then if it's multiple acres like that, or do you take out part of it, like on these huge acreages?
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsett, first of all, if it's county-owned, it probably doesn't have any tax liability right now, so it wouldn't. There'd be no way it could participate in this program. I mean, it could participate,
there are,
I suppose,
others,
but
others that are privately
sure,
owned.
Sure. Second, I would think that every local community, before they adopt an ordinance of this type, would be taking a look at the situation in their community and saying, is this a winner or a loser for us? Do we need to put some more sideboards on to our own local ordinance to make sure we don't get eaten alive? Certainly that would be a reasonable approach. And there's language on page 2 of the bill, line 32, that says the city county report may adopt any other provisions relating to the property tax incentive programs that do not conflict with the requirements of the bill. So that provides, I think, a lot of flexibility for local governments to shape their program to their own local circumstances. I think a community that's looking at a vast quantity of brownfields in their most valuable lands, if they're privately owned, would either think twice about adopting this program, limit it to fewer years, put a budgetary cap on it. There are all kinds of ways that they might be able to shape their own program to make sure that they're protected. So that's the best I can do.
So if I may follow up, when brownfields are identified and they are, for example, a mill site that is considered contaminated for some reason, and there are many acres, I don't really know how brownfields are identified. So is it the entire acreage, or is it just where, you know, they had machinery? I'm asking,
right,
can they break out parts of the brownfield?
Go ahead.
Chair Barnard, Representative Woodson, I believe it depends on the tax lots, okay, and it depends on where the DEQ and others have identified the brownfield. So I think it's a fact-specific question.
Okay.
but the bill does exclude the superfunds and such, and it includes industrial property, and that means those that are already that are still operating, because those are usually the million, I believe. The Department of Revenue would be able to correct me on the details, but I think it's the million and up. That's what's assessed by the Department of Revenue and is considered industrial, and so this does not cover that. So we're not talking about the biggest ones. We're focusing on the smaller ones, the dry cleaners, the gas stations, the other miscellaneous ones, so that we don't have this problem of properties that are on the tax rolls that we are receiving revenue from, and all of a sudden those ones are able to take advantage of it. We're not including that with this with this right now.
Great, thank you.
So that exclusion is a page 2, the term state appraised industrial property. It's page 2, line 14. So for those large operating industrial facilities,
1 million is industrial,
I believe, that's
or above.
Did I say state approved? State appraised, if I didn't say it properly.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the question over in the House Representative Davis had to save me on, so I think he knows the answer.
I think it's one.
Okay, John.
Okay, that's among the exclusions that we're
It's an exclusion.
Were there other? I have a bunch of questions, but I'll defer. Representative Helm?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Randy, can you scope this for us a little bit in terms of the size of property most likely to be targeted? You were getting to it right there, but I remember, I think this related issue came in front of the Environment and Energy Committee last session, and you provided the four of us that are on that committee, three of us on that committee, with a map of our own district and where there were contaminated sites. When I looked at the map of my district, it was pretty evident that most of the sites were probably former filling stations on small lots. So could you give us some sort of idea, maybe based on that analysis, what are the range of acreage sizes that we're looking at, and what might your guess be about the most likely target of this type of tax abatement policy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Helm, you know what? I think I am not the right person to answer that question. I think we'd be better off getting a better answer than I could give you just off this from the seat of my pants here, from somebody involved with the state brownfield program, or some, you know, actually going ahead and getting the information for you. I know there are thousands of these sites in the Portland metropolitan region, and I know that also there are thousands of small sites and few large sites, but the large sites actually, you know, are the ones that are the poster children in many ways. And many of those large sites, as we noted a minute ago, would be excluded from participation in this program if they're a federal Superfund site, if they're a state-appraised industrial facility. So we are thinking, as Mike said, largely about the kinds of things Representative Frederick was talking about, the small neighborhood sites, the relatively you know, modest-sized sites. But I don't think, you know, that in order to limit it, the impact of this legislation to those sites, that would have to be done in a local ordinance. And so I'd rather go and get you some better information than I can just, you know, pull out of the air here today.
Thank you. That'd be helpful.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what comes first, the cleanup or the tax abatement? Does the cleanup have to be complete for the tax abatement to occur, or can the tax abatement occur simply based on a proposal that's certified by the local entity?
The tax abatement or the tax benefits would only apply to remaining cleanup when they're approved. Correct me if I'm wrong here, Wendy. So if you've already done the cleanup, then too late for this. You would have to go in for the approval and then conduct your tax exemption and special assessment, and then conduct your cleanup under DEQ oversight. When you go in, you provide an estimate of the costs, and that helps to determine the amount of the tax reduction. And then there are provisions in the legislation for checking back in each year about how much remains to be done, changing of the estimated costs, et cetera. But no, if you've done the cleanup first before you apply for your tax exemption, too late.
All right, Mr. Chair, I understand that. I guess I'm just trying to think about the logistics of the process. You know, if I had a project, came to you and said, this is my piece of property, I would like to clean it up so I can get this, you know, this tax benefit, I go ahead and do it on my nickel, and I do it to DEQ standards. I have them still sign off on it, and then I bring you the completion notice from DEQ. We're done. You don't have to be monitoring my effort over the course of the next 5, 6, 7, 8 years. And I would be done. I'd have my investment, and I'd start recouping my returns, if you will, on the reduced property tax bills and so forth. But what you're saying is the process would be ongoing. The cleanup happens after the abatement promise is extended to the property owner, correct?
Well, if you want to get a tax benefit, that's right. You apply,
I get it.
And you have to state at that time how mm-hmm. much you intend to spend on your cleanup. It has to be backed up by...
And it's an estimate.
It's an estimate, but it's backed up by engineering reports, et cetera.
As we all know, once you, it's hard to know right. what's under the ground oftentimes.
Well, and we also...
Estimates are going to be pretty rough sometimes as well.
We also, broke our brains a little bit with hypothetical scenarios where, the ultimate cost ended up being vastly more or vastly less than was estimated up front. So I think, there will probably be some experience that is gained if this bill becomes law and local governments implement this program about how to manage those sort of probably outlier situations.
Okay. Mazin?
Actually, that is in the bill a chance to amend the costs
right.
every year.
Every year.
Right. So you could amend those costs and increase them or reduce them.
And that would be subject to the approval of the jurisdiction.
Right. That's correct.
So if I understood what you said earlier, just kind of in aid of that question, if I understood what you said earlier, you only get a tax abatement for money you've actually spent. So you go in and ask for the abatement, bringing in your plan for the abatement. But you wouldn't actually get any tax break until you'd spent the money. Is that right?
No,
Mr. Chair. You would, once you are approved by the local jurisdiction, then you'd have a freeze in your land value under the special assessment, and you'd have the exemption of your improvement value under the exemption side of the program immediately. And you would be spending the money after that, most likely, to do the cleanup. And it's not calibrated dollar for dollar. It's over the course of the entire cleanup that, the caps apply. So if you spend a lot of money in your first year and not as much money in the second year, or you spend very little money in the first year because you're having studies done, but you spend a lot of money in the second year, your tax level has already been established by the program that you've entered. Am I correct?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not going to be every year getting a reimbursement for the money you spent that year. You have a tax exemption, and it's set, and then you're spending money over time. And then there are clawback provisions if you end up just not doing the work or whatever in the course of the cleanup.
Mr. Chair, could I add to that?
Yeah, please.
So Mr. Tucker has it right that so you're applying for this status, you freeze the land, and then you're also getting an exemption for improvements if your application's approved. So if you have nothing on the land right now, you're just going to get your land frozen at the dirty price. So it's essentially pretty much nothing for property taxes on the land. So that will stay at that level throughout the process, and you're certifying how much the city, county, or port will certify approve what you're estimating as your cost, and then that's what they can go up to, and then it can change each year if the cost goes up or cost goes down. That's what you can get in benefits up to that. But if you would stop or something, you're going to have to pay back any benefits that you'd gotten. So that's the clawback provisions. And so the incentive is to get improvements on, get that property cleaned up and improvements on it as quick as possible, or you're never going to get your cleanup costs back. If there's already an improvement on the property, you'll be getting an exemption going forward right away, but that's really a fact-specific situation of what's on that property already. But you're never going to get more benefit than the cleanup costs. And the clawback provision is important because as soon as you hit your cost, that's what you've gotten benefits in, say, property taxes, then you're not going to get it anymore going forward. So it ceases right then. So it sounds complicated, but, I mean, it is really essentially how it has to work to make sure we don't over-incentivize. Or give away taxes.
Representative Lanniger?
Thank you. Thanks for being here today. And I have to say, as a former county commissioner, I like the way in which you've tailored this program to be something that local governments can choose to enact if they want to and can layer additional constraints on. I was speaking with a Clackamas County commissioner earlier today who noted that Clackamas County, which is careful about freezing tax revenue and worries about other uses, said that they support this program. And I do think that other special districts, at least in Clackamas, have come to the table to try to negotiate conditions if there are freezings of property tax revenue to make sure that it makes sense for all the tax beneficiaries in the community. So I like the structure that you've added, and I like also that it looks like local governments and industry people and in prior iterations and now environmental protection advocates are all united behind this bill. I think if we want to safeguard farmland and natural areas, environmental protection advocates need to be interested in brownfield redevelopment. And if you're industry and you want to create good businesses close to transportation, you also want to be supportive of brownfield redevelopment. So I like how it meets a lot of needs. Thanks for your work.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other, Representative Davis, did you have another?
Oh, thank you, Chair. I was just going to mention that the end of the bill, well, Section 7 towards the end on page 5, specifies the instances in which a property would be disqualified from the program, and that includes failing to comply with the requirements adopted by the city or the county, failing to begin making remediation or making progress on remediation. And to me, the intent there would be the remediation plan is presented as part of the application with the local jurisdiction, and if either that doesn't begin or if no progress is reasonably being made on that plan, the property would be disqualified and would come back on the rolls at that point. So we've tried to sort of hit all the high points of tax policy that we like to talk about, I think, of having some self-imposed limits, having clawbacks, and also having a sunset built in so that this doesn't run away.
I have several questions, and I think one of them, I might as well start with the one that was generated by Representative Johnson's set of questions. On the clawback that you were describing, is that then simply an unpaid tax yet to be paid on the property, or is it something else?
If there's a disqualifying, Mr. Chair, if there's a disqualifying event, as the section that Representative Davis referenced, the benefit would stop, and then the next section, that section also provides that you would owe back taxes of what you got in the incentive. So you don't want to mess up on this. You need to get it right and continue the program, or you're going to owe what you got as a benefit already. We are going to ask for a little bit of an amendment on that one because we don't want a technical mistake to take you away from that benefit. So it would be at the discretion of the city or county or port to, you know, waive that if it's like a late report or a misunderstanding of something,
right?
We can fix it. So we just need a technical there. But yeah, if you're disqualified, there will be a communication back to the assessor to stop it and to impose those taxes that were what you got as a benefit. That's why there's that extra accounting, that there's the request from the assessors for the extra work, because there'll be a notation of what was saved to the property owner in the tax log. So that clawback is ready to go.
Thank you. My second question, maybe easier, maybe more difficult, I'm not sure. It occurs to me that if I'm the owner of a seriously debilitated piece of property, and somebody comes along and says, I'd like to buy your property, and I'm going to go apply for this tax abatement situation under this bill, that at that point, suddenly my property has become worth more money than what it would have been worth in its debilitated state. Has anybody looked into that issue as a possible concern about the way in which this would have the effect on current brownfield property values?
Mr. Chair, I think yes, because we looked at, well, what is the value of the property? You look at the real market value and you subtract off the cleanup costs, and if your real market value just went up because this program is here, That's going to be taken into account and what we're going to freeze it at. So you can't totally, you can't really game the system in that way because it's going to take into account what that property is worth.
I see. So the value of the property as a brownfield will be evaluated based on the market, the price of, that it was, that was paid for it.
It's, that goes one of the factors, yes.
As one of the factors. So that's a way then of preventing the seller from gaming the system. I think it would be really helpful for us, since we're obviously going to look at this bill again if you bring in amendments that we can then enact. It would be really helpful, I think, to have a couple of the examples that you've already looked at to try to understand how these pieces fit together. Representative Bence's question at the very beginning of this conversation, I think, is illustrative of the kind of concerns that I have about it. And then the question I've been raising just now about valuing the property, and what it means then to compare the value of an ongoing usable asset after it's been cleaned up and something's been built on it and so forth versus the value of the debilitated property and what it is the public has invested in that in order to help get it there and what that means. I think maybe you've covered the key issues, but I'm not sure, and I'd sure like us to be able to look at some examples and think about that a bit, even though it is a short session. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Woodson.
Yeah, I just wondered if you have, in any capacity, sort of determined what the total dollar amount that you anticipate this exemption would prevent the taxes, equal taxes, from being paid. Do you have some idea of how, what kind of numbers of people you have out there that want to do this and what kind of it, an impact it's going to have on the counties that allow it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodson, I don't think we do have an estimate. As noted before, there are 13,000 brownfields around the state. For some of those brownfields, this might be a useful tool. We haven't really been able to figure, we haven't done any work to try to ascertain which ones it would work for. We don't know which local governments, we have a sense of some local governments that are interested in it, but obviously over time, there might be some early adopters at the local level who, either have successes or failures, which will inform subsequent decisions by local communities. So I think over time, it's really hard to estimate that.
And there's no interest earned either way on that. It's straight dollars. If I spend $10,000 on a cleanup, that's what I get in property taxes. And if my taxes would have been $2,000 a year and I pay nothing instead, it takes 5 years to recoup.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. The bill doesn't address that question at all, so I assume that's true.
So the present value of money doesn't matter.
The present value of money doesn't matter. So
right.
That's the estimate. That's the estimating process is through the present value.
Now, wait a minute. Say that again so I can understand it.
The costs that you incur to fix the problem is estimated through a present value process.
The estimate.
Right.
Estimate.
Right.
But the actual amount you would get as a property tax break over time is the actual dollar spent, isn't it?
Actual.
Yeah.
Well, it's two ways of doing it, right? There is, you either go through the special assessment, so you have the real market value minus what you're going to spend.
Yeah.
That leaves you with a value. You apply the ratio of, real market value to assessed value to it, and then you're taxed on that. That's the tax bill, right? And that's what you get. The reduction in the special assessment. The other way, you could either get a full credit or full exemption or a partial exemption based on how the county or the city goes with that assumption. So there are different ways of doing it.
You can see why I want the examples.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes, thank you. All right, let's go on and hear from the city of Bend. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on this bill, 4084? I don't see anybody, so you're up.
Looks like it's just me. For the record, Eric Kanzler, representing the City of Bend. Thank you for the opportunity.
And that's an N. Kanzler?
Kanzler, yes. I suffer from a difficult last name to pronounce and poor handwriting. So I can't sit up here and talk to you as a tax expert, but I can talk to you about the practical benefits of this policy in the City of Bend. Bend actually doesn't have a lot of brownfield properties, but we do have one in particular on the west side of the city, roughly 76 acres, a former demolition landfill that's owned by the county, and we receive at present no tax benefit from it. It's an exempt property. It happens to be sited near the expanding OSU Cascades, and it's a site that it's still county owned. It presumably wouldn't be county owned at some point once a development process is undertaken, and it's struggled. It's still sitting there pretty much in the same state. And we hear so often that there's no one tool. And so I could say at this point, we know with the assemblage of tools that's available, it hasn't yet unlocked this property. That's part of the explanation. And I certainly can't sit here and say this tool absolutely will unlock this property. But what I can say is when I've discussed this policy proposal with the City of Bend, that they were very excited, that they saw a tremendous opportunity in exploring their ability to craft a policy at the local level that could have an impact on that property. This is a property that presumably would provide much-needed student housing, potentially industrial development, R&D development related to the construction of the university, and any number of other things that might be suitable for that part of town. So when we look at the build-out of that part of town, which is a very big part of our priorities related to the university and otherwise, we see a lot of promise in a policy of this nature, and for that reason, we're very supportive of continuing to explore it, vet it as need be, and move it forward with some ability for the local government to consider utilizing it for the purposes that it's seeking to accomplish. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Davis and Representative Whitson.
Thank you, Chair. And Eric, your timing couldn't be more perfect as we're talking about a potential example to run this through. And without getting into specifics, it sounds like the city might look to a potential selling either part or all of this property to a private party, in which case it would go on to the tax rolls. If you could find somebody who would be willing to take an old, what was this property?
It's a demolition landfill. It has a lot of old equipment and
sounds lovely.
Heavy. Yeah. It's a lot of
sounds
fun.
Sounds pristine. So it sounds like an opportunity to utilize this incentive, frankly, to say if a private purchaser were to take it, it's not worth much now, but your cost of cleanup could be amortized.
Yes. And I think it's also fair to say that one of the lenses that we take when we look at this property as a tax-exempt property is while we would be looking at a tax break on income revenue as that was coming in, the premise of it is what we're left with is not only something that serves specific purposes that builds up, but it would build up the tax base over time. And again, I can't look to this tool and say that it's absolutely going to enable that. But I can say that eyes got very big in the room when I talked with staff in the city manager's office about it. They were very, very interested in looking at those details and having an opportunity to consider putting that to work.
Representative, what's it?
I think that answered my question, because if it was on the county tax rolls, it's not paying taxes, which is what I was talking about before. So those properties would be sold to a private developer with the express purpose then of acting as an intermediary and taking advantage of the tax deduction or whatever, and then turning around and selling it to someone else.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, that's roughly our sense of what would likely happen in a scenario like that, is that there would potentially be an intermediate. Now, if the university itself went to purchase that property, which doesn't look like it's in the cards right now, they would be a tax-exempt organization, and so this wouldn't really apply to them. But under these scenarios in which it was partially developed by them and partially developed by a private entity or wholly developed by a private entity, then there would certainly be some benefit to that entity for a period of time.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank
with
you.
That, with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4084 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 4081. Kyle, do you want to come up and... We had a bit of an introduction to this bill from the members. Do you want to add anything to that?
I can just point to a few things I put up in all lists that might be helpful to committee members.
If there's something that they didn't already talk about, that would be great.
Okay. To the committee members, there was already introduction. I mean, what the bill does itself is pretty straightforward. It's fairly short. It eliminates a sunset for a property tax exemption that's available to nonprofit corporations that in this case were receiving an exemption in the tax year 2012-13, and they actually offered and occupied and used the property as low-income housing. So it really is, it's an extension of a sunset for an exemption that was made available in House Bill 4039, which passed in the 2014 session. So it's eliminating the sunset that was placed when House Bill 4039 passed. And so I have a copy of that is up in the meeting materials under OLIS. And without going into too much background, especially in the interest of time, part of this came about because of a court decision, and House Bill 4039 was in some ways a response to that allowed these properties that were previously exempt. It clarified that they were not, current law did not provide an exemption for them under ORS 307-130. So you can find the court case, it's in OLIS as well under the meeting materials, and since the tax court made that decision, there's been a settlement in the case, and I also have the settlement language up there, which more or less takes the properties that were involved in the court case and places them under the purview of the 4039. So if you make a change to the sunset here as proposed in this bill, it would affect those properties that were in the court case. So I guess the important takeaway there is these are a group of properties that have received the exemption in the past, and it is a finite number. New properties that are in the same, they're nonprofit owned and they're low income, that were newly acquired or something of that nature would not receive this exemption because it is a static one back in time. So it's a static group going forward.
Thank you. Let's hear from the panel. Ellen Miller, Jim Seymour, John Van Landingham, Emily Ryman. I note that we have about 20 minutes left today, so expedition is of value, but I do want you to be able to explain the bill and present what you need to present.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ellen Miller with CFM, here representing Catholic Community Services Foundation. I'm here today with Jim Seymour, the executive director of the foundation, and Jim will talk more about the actual properties and the importance of this existing property tax exemption for the financial model to keep these properties. We're here, obviously, in support of House Bill 4081, and we ask for your support. Before I get started, I'd like to thank Representative Evans and Representative Davis and your committee administrator really introducing the bill well. Stole a lot of my thunder. A lot of what I had to say has been said, so thank you for that. Really, we just wanted to add some context to the tax court opinion that has been withdrawn as part of the settlement. That tax court opinion was based on the fact that the nonprofits did not meet the exclusive occupancy requirement. So due to landlord-tenant law, the low-income housing tenants, they have a lease, and that lease gives those tenants rights to that property. Therefore, the nonprofit does not have a exclusive use to that property or occupancy. So that was really the issue. What has happened since we had that conversation in 2014 around House Bill 4039 is that there was the settlement, so there is not a Supreme Court opinion. We had set the sunset in 2014 with the anticipation that there would be a Supreme Court opinion to guide this work. As soon as we found out that the Supreme Court opinion would not be received, we wanted to bring it back to the legislature to get your input on this. And really, we put together this proposal because we felt that this was a bill that was appropriate for the short session, a quick fix, and something that would really help provide assurance for the nonprofit providers. So thank you again for your time today. Thank you for this hearing. And now I'd like to pass it over to Jim.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Seymour. I am the executive director of both Catholic Community Services of the Mid-Willamette Valley and Catholic Community Services Foundation. Catholic Community Services provides social services for about 2,000 people on any given day. And Catholic Community Services Foundation, in addition to some other things, provides affordable housing for about 1,000 children and adults on any given day. I can honestly say I've been at Catholic Community Services for the last 45 years, and I have never in that 45 years felt the kind of pressure that we are feeling now. We offer what we call a non-discriminatory preference for, in our housing for parents who are willing and able to protect and nurture their own children, but need support in order to be able to do so. Oftentimes the basic support is housing. You can't provide a safe place for your children if you don't have one. We also serve kids who are aging out of the foster care system on their own, and adults with intellectual disabilities, as well as adults with mental illness. And all those populations, just the pressure on the affordable housing, like I say, I've never seen it. And it's right that we're looking at how do we expand that housing? That's very important, but it's just as important that we not lose the affordable housing that we have available. And I can tell you there is no margin in this housing. We developed this housing with the understanding that it would be tax exempt. And we have to keep that tax exemption if we are going to be able to keep the housing. That's, I guess, my fundamental point. That was the deal we made when we built it, and we built no margin in. And if you take that away, then what ends up happening, the only place I can imagine that we would get the money would be on our replacement reserves. And as soon as you do that, the properties will start to deteriorate, they'll start to fall apart, and they will become non-usable. I'd just like to read to you in a report published by Meyer Memorial Trust in 2015 entitled The Cost of Affordable Housing Development in Oregon. The authors say, subsidized affordable housing differs from market rate development in fundamental ways that tend to add costs. Affordable housing is a specific and unusual niche in the real estate development premised on the basic fact that the tenants cannot pay the full cost of their housing. Long-term affordability drives a housing model fundamentally dependent on public subsidies. So that's the end of the quote. So property tax exemption has always been one of the most important public subsidies for affordable housing. And again, without it, I believe much of our current affordable housing stock will quickly deteriorate and eventually be lost altogether. And so I therefore urge you to support House Bill 4081. Thank you very much.
John.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Van Landingham. I'm a legal aid lawyer for Lane County Legal Aid. I do a lot of work on landlord-tenant law and on affordable housing property tax exemptions. So I'm largely here to answer questions, but I want to make a couple of introductory comments to set the stage for you. Keep in mind that we're talking about ORS 307-130, what people like me refer to as the general charitable property tax exemption. It covers property, quote, this is a quote, property actually and exclusively occupied or used in the literary, benevolent, charitable, or scientific work carried on by a charity. What does that mean? There are dozens of Oregon Supreme Court cases trying to determine what that means. Those are broad terms. Some assessors, and these are decided by the local assessor, at the local assessor's discretion, some assessors have included affordable housing in that description. Some have not. The court case, Oregon Tax Court case, made a ruling that essentially disqualified affordable housing from qualifying under that language. The other significant factor here for you to keep in mind is that we expected to negotiate with the counties and the assessors for 2017 session to address our particular issue about affordable housing. But something happened in the meantime. You've got bigger fish to fry with 307-130. You all had a meeting last fall in which you identified that, and you created a work group which is going to rethink all of 307-130. I believe that's being co-chaired by Representative Leininger and Bentz. We would be a part of that. We hope to be a part of that, because rethinking all of 307-130 will address our particular issue. So we're asking to keep the status quo while that rethink goes on. That's all we're asking for. It's not an open-ended extension of our status quo, because rethinking 307-130 will address us. It'll address all the entities, and there are lots of them, that have qualified over the years in different counties as a charitable use. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please, yes.
Sure. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Emily Ryman. I'm here today actually in two capacities, both as the executive director of NEDCO, which is itself a nonprofit affordable housing developer, and also as a board member for the Oregon Opportunity Network, which is Oregon's membership association for affordable housing developers. Both Oregonon and NEDCO have submitted letters of support for this bill, and I just want to add a couple of things to the testimony you've already heard. One is that Oregonon has surveyed our member organizations and estimate that almost 2,000 units are directly impacted by the extension of this exemption. These units are all over the state of Oregon, from the far northwest corner to Baker City, down to Medford, and everywhere in between. And as you've heard, the affordability of these units themselves and the viability of the projects overall for those 1,800 units are directly tied to this exemption. NEDCO recently experienced just how fine these margins are to make a project viable. When we actually were denied an exemption for a new project here in Salem, everything else was in place, but the lack of the property tax exemption forced us to back out of that project completely. I know that this extension doesn't address new projects, but it illustrates what a finely tuned equation it is to make an affordable housing project balance, and how important the property tax exemption is in that equation. So I would urge you to support this bill and support those 1,800 units of affordable housing, actually more than that across the state, because those are just those represented by Oregonon members. This is a very needed extension, as John said, until we can work on the more permanent solution. Thank you.
Thank you much. Questions? Representative Whitsitt?
Yes. I was wondering if the entities that you're referring to receive state or federal subsidies already for low-income housing.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, typically yes. The particular case that the Oregon Tax Court decided involved properties in Linn County that were federal tax credit projects. So there was a federal tax credit involved. I don't know what additional subsidies were involved, but there probably were additional subsidies to get the construction costs down so that they could be affordable. Does that answer your question? So yes, there are other subsidies in these properties. Typically, one of these properties has somewhere around 10 different subsidy sources.
Okay. And a follow-up would be, what is the total tax exemption we're looking at a statewide level for re-implementing this exemption?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, remind you that we're not re-implementing, we're sort of freezing the status quo. Your staff's analysis in 2014 indicated that the total property tax exemption under 307.130 was something like $157 million, but that there was no way to break out the cost just for affordable housing projects. Those are done county by county. There is no statewide register of those properties that I'm aware of.
So we don't know the influence thing?
Representative Whitsitt, during when House Bill 4039 passed, it might have been in part due to time constraint. The way that we get the information right now on ORS 307-130 is one lump sum. It comes into the Department of Revenue, and they share that with us. So at the time, it was kind of the estimate. It was still under review, too, so it even said the revenue estimate said it could be zero, depending upon the Supreme Court decision. But a range was given in light of the difficulty of obtaining the information. Right now, I've reached out to the county assessors, all 36 county assessors. Don't have full response at this point. Figured they'd have a few days to respond, but hopefully we'll have a good number on the specific ones that are affected by this. So far, I've had about 10 counties respond, and a few of them have had properties, but for the most part, this is definitely a small subset of that overall exemption.
So will we have that before we vote on it in committee, do you think, the number, the total?
I can definitely, as soon as I have it available. I told them, ask the assessors to please have it to me by Thursday.
Okay, great, thank you.
Okay, other questions? Representative Langer, please.
Thank you. Thanks for your work on this and for bringing the issue forward. It's really important. Am I right in understanding that the law as it currently stands enables local jurisdictions to decide if they want to provide this property tax exemption? It's not a blanket exemption that's being imposed by the legislature on all affordable housing properties. It's a jurisdiction by jurisdiction choice about whether to allow that exemption. Is that correct?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Leininger, it is an assessor by assessor decision under 307-130 for any sort of, whether you're talking about OMSI or the Red Cross or his affordable housing projects in Marion County. So the individual assessor can do that.
Well, it's a fact-based evaluation.
It's a fact-based evaluation.
I mean, it isn't a discretionary evaluation. They actually have to figure out what the facts are and try to apply that to the statute, don't they?
Chair Barnhart, as a lawyer, and you are a lawyer also, you will know that those words that I read earlier are pretty broad.
Yes.
So there's a question about, is it a charity? Yeah, that's fairly easy. Is it a 501c3? Okay, fine. Is affordable housing a charitable use? Yes. But what about these other questions? That's where the tax court got hung up. So you're right that it is a fact-based analysis, and I believe that the Department of Revenue gives guidance to the assessors about this, but you can get different decisions from different assessors about whether affordable housing qualifies under this statute.
I don't want to quibble, but I think what you're saying is that because the categories are so broad and so vague, assessors may end up with different conclusions based on the same facts.
Well, I would never quibble with the chair.
What the point was that I was trying to make was that technically, at least, it isn't discretionary. Once the assessors determine that the facts apply, then the result is determined by the statute, not by the wishes of the assessor.
Mr. Chair, I would agree with that, except that in this particular case, the case that brought this forward, the county assessor approved these projects. And all of these that are being carried forward are already approved.
Yes.
But now there's a policy position being taken, I think from DOR, but I'm not positive of that, in which the county assessor withdrew that approval. So at one time, it was determined to be a charity under 307.030, and then another time it was determined not to be.
Right. I interrupted, and I want to get back to Representative Leninger. She has a different point, I think.
I would say simply that I think for projects that were developed and have been operating based on an understanding of operating costs and revenue sources, that if we change the rules midstream without a pretty thorough, thoughtful evaluation of it, that could be a real problem. And so I like the idea of extending through the period of this work group trying to figure out an appropriate approach to status quo, because it can be pretty tumultuous for organizations operating on a very thin margin like affordable housing nonprofits do.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel? The current sunset is July 1st, 2018. I don't know when the work group's going to finish, but I'm hoping it's in time to get us a bill for 17. What would be wrong with waiting until? What's the problem we're going to solve by passing this bill today instead of dealing with it as part of the larger bill? There may very well be a problem we're going to solve. I just don't know what it is.
Chair Barnhart, for the record, Ellen Miller with CFM and Catholic Community Services Foundation again. We really wanted to come back to you, really just to get that input on kind of where you're at with this issue. So we really wanted to start the discussion earlier. We would like to know that will happen in 2017, but if the work group, as they're dealing with multiple stakeholders in this building and coming up with solutions for those stakeholders, if we will be a small voice at that table, and we're concerned that maybe this issue may not get addressed in time.
Chair Frank, John Van Lanningham, having read all those tax court and Supreme Court decisions, I am concerned that meeting a 2017 deadline by the work group is going to be very difficult. There are a lot of interested parties that are going to be interested in what you do with this exemption.
Chair Barnhart, may I respond to your question?
Yes, please. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would like you to know that from the standpoint of a nonprofit doing this and a board of directors that raises a lot of money to help put together this housing, we feel very uncertain. The last two housing projects, affordable housing projects that we built, we get taxed on. That tax bill is $40,000 a year. So we had to build that into the equation for all the new stuff. And then we're looking at the property that the affordable housing that we built prior, and it maintains its tax exemption. But our board is very nervous about what's going to happen in our case in Marion County, where we know the assessor has made a determination that it should be taxed if this doesn't go forward. And so we would just like some certitude that we can focus on continuing to improve the properties that we have and build new affordable housing and not have to be wondering whether or not we might get the rug pulled out from underneath us on an agreement, again, we made. When we built this housing, it was with the understanding that this subsidy would be in place. That was our business model. And I so appreciate what Representative Leininger said. It's not fair to change the deal after we've signed all the, you know, after we've done the deal. So thank you.
Yeah, I'm asking a very specific kind of question, and that really is, what is the, other than the anxiety of your board, what is the reason to make a change today if we are looking at the entire section of the statute, and that may very well be a part of the solution that's contained in that work group report and the bill that the work group drafts. There may very well be a good reason not to wait. I just haven't heard it yet.
Mr. Chair, can I respond?
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. I think you've raised a very good question, which came to my mind when this bill was brought to me, because I knew of the ongoing work of the work group. And so I asked myself, what's potentially special about this situation? I think on a substantive grounds, what is important is that this is people's homes that they're living in. You know, we've dealt with this issue with museums and things like that, which certainly have very important places in our communities. But the cost of housing and the fact that this affects where people live, I think, raises the specter of the importance of this particular exemption. And then second, in terms of the urgency, as I've had it expressed to me by folks who actually are not part of clients of mine who are not part of subsidized communities, who at one time enjoyed a subsidy from federal and other sources, and now this is the last exemption they have that's keeping their prices down, is that sense of, boy, this could change. We've seen assessors do it in other areas, and if this changes, although we're no longer under federal agreements for what our rents have to be, the result will have to be higher rents simply because this is the last subsidy left.
Thank you. I think that answers the question for me.
I would add, John Millenningham, that if these projects are going to lose this grandfathered, grandparented exemption, the more time they have to adjust, the better, because they're going to have to close the projects or raise a bunch of money to make up the difference. And that's ongoing. That's an operating expense ongoing every year.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you, gentlemen, very much. We have three more people who would like to be heard. We are technically out of time, but I think we can run for a few more minutes. Wendy Johnson, Elizabeth Remley, and Gil Rydell, please. And we'll let Gil go first because he's the one who said he's against it. So let's hear from
Gil. Mr. Chair, Gil Rydell, Association of Warren Counties. For the record, the commissioners were in town today, and they designated me to be the sourpuss.
Okay. Please sour away.
But I was very impressed, and these are folks I know. The compromise in 2014 resulted from negotiating CCS and AOC. We came up with a sunset. Your point is one of the salient points. The sunset is in July 1, 2018. There's two sessions after this that occur before that sunset activates, not one. But it's difficult. In fact, it's frankly possible to me to imagine that the work group that's dealing with this statute was so well described by Jonathan Leininger as a mess. And anyone who wants to read it will know it's a mess. And the assessors, this is not a local option statute, applies statewide. It doesn't make sense. It's a patchwork, and the assessors don't know what to do with it. That's why you have this work group.
Oh, you're talking about the statute.
I'm talking about
307, that is exactly why we set up the work group.
Yes, yeah. 307-130, which yes. caused the work group. The point I want to make there is I can't imagine that for some reason the work group would say, oh, let's not apply an exemption to low-income housing. I mean, it's in the law. This, they sought that exemption under the wrong statute. This 307-130 is a mishmash, and it's awful. It needs to be blown up. And I hope you do that. And I hope you have a new bill in hand for the 2017 session. There happens to be a statutory series that fits this situation perfectly. And it does provide a local opt-in. It's entitled the Nonprofit Corporation Low-Income Housing Law, ORS 307-540 to 307-548. Now, I believe CCS attempted to use that first, if I remember the facts from 2 years ago. The problem is the local opt-in. And so one of the things the work group maybe ought to consider is making this more user-friendly, because this is specific to what they want. 307-140 is not, and it needs to go away, because it's made a mess of property tax exemptions for years. So I guess shortness of time, Sourpuss, your point about we've got time here. We've got time. And what the commissioners told me was that they wanted these folks at the table. Maybe some stress about the 2018 sunset will cause them to fully participate in a comprehensive solution of both this statute 307-130 and making this series, which applies directly to them, more user friendly. So, end of my comments.
You may have just expanded the work group charge. I don't know for sure. Please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Elizabeth Remley here today on behalf of Shelter Care, which is one of Lane County's largest low-income housing providers. We just want to say to Catholic Community Services, thanks for bringing this bill. We're in full support of it. We have Shelter Care has several properties in Eugene and one property in Springfield. Eugene has exercised the local opt-in that Gil described. So all of their properties in Eugene are exempt under that statute. However, Springfield has not exercised that local opt-in, and so their only chance to be property tax exempt is under this messy statute. They are currently property tax exempt. Their 16 units serve developmentally disabled and mentally ill adults who work in their community in Springfield. If something like this were to go away, if Springfield decided to assess the AFIA apartments under a property tax, Shelter Care would probably move those units to Eugene, where it's property tax exempt, and people wouldn't be able to live in their local community. And I think that's the big concern here, is that we have disparate applications of the law in different places because of the way that assessors are choosing to apply the law. And we have an opportunity to have low-income housing in some places but not others, and so people can't live in their communities where they work and where they're from. So we would urge you to remove the sunset for now. We really look forward to participating in the work group. We think that this is something that needs to be addressed on a statewide basis. In the meantime, though, providing certainty to nonprofits who operate on the very, very low margins is something that I think this short session can accomplish.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities, another property tax exemption bill. So seems to be the issues of the day. I think Gil's covered a lot of the same issues I was going to mention. The League is in an awkward spot here because we care about affordable housing across the state. This exemption, the narrowly tailored, I mean, this really only applies to this group in the litigation set, would continue to get this exemption forever if this bill would pass, because it takes away the sunset altogether. And so that's our concern, is this is one of Catholic Charities is one of the big social welfare organizations out there, and we want them at the table for this task force. And this sort of takes away the incentive, frankly, for part of it, at least for this chunk of the litigation. But we understand that this issue was there at the beginning, and they've had this exemption. So it's an awkward spot. Perhaps the potential compromise is extending it another year or something, but not as it's totally is written now, it totally lifts that exemption. But as has been said, there is the general charitable exemption that's confusing and nobody knows what it means. But last session, you fixed existing law that provided property tax exemption for affordable housing and made it a local option that was clearer. That was in House Bill 2130. I think that's the one that Representative Leininger was talking about, that it's a local option. So you have that program that this organization could go and utilize if that
if they're county or if it's a city, authorized. And so it's a local choice. That's the type of property tax exemption that the league will continue to advocate for. The way this sunset is, it's an automatic that the legislature has decided that all this group should get it forever. And that's why we have some pushback on it. But the contrast is it's affordable housing, which is important to us. The league is working on a property tax report. It should be coming out hopefully in the next few weeks. And in doing that research and looking at the Department of Revenue's new statistics from the fiscal year, I was pretty shocked to learn how much we really are giving up in the various categories. We give money away in the business category, the social welfare, and the public categories. And so these numbers will make you understand why it's so important to us. We imposed approximately just over $11 billion in property taxes.
Do you know what the numbers are for this under this bill?
I don't know for this specific, but for social welfare generally, we lost $194 million for the 130. That's the charitable. We lost 194. So I don't know how much exactly of the housing, but in the category of social welfare under the ORS 307-130, it was $194 million. The religion categories, the 140 was $113 million. But if you look at all the exemptions and special assessments, we imposed $11 billion in taxes, and we exempted $23 billion. So we exempted twice of what we actually got. So these exemptions, they all stack up. We all have our pet ones that we think are really important. This one is a good one, but we think it needs to be looked at, as has been said. The charitable one is just impossible for assessors to apply, and that's why we're happy about your work group.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Thank you very much for your testimony today. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4081. Colleagues, we're going to carry over the public hearing on House Bill.
We don't have any testimony going, just real quick.
On House Bill 4027 till Wednesday. With that, we're not meeting tomorrow. The keepers of the schedule have decreed no Tuesday meetings for us. We will not meet tomorrow. We will meet on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And with that, the committee is adjourned.
And so we don't have any test.